is officially ended and Turkey's key presidential and parliamentary elections seen as a litmus test for President Erdogan and his ruling party. An Egypt-brokered ceasefire comes into effect in the besieged Gaza Strip after 5 days of Israeli strikes that claimed more than 30 Palestinian lives. Fresh fighting in Sudan. The conflict between the army and a major paramilitary force shows no sign of abating. It's good to have you with us. Now, beginning with Turkey, where polls have closed in key presidential and parliamentary elections, partial results are expected in an hour's time. Some 64 million people were eligible to elect a president and parliament for a 5-year term. Turnout was reported to be huge. The elections are effectively a referendum on Turkey's longest-serving leader, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, ruling Justice and Development Party. His main rival is opposition leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Opinion polls had predicted a tight race. Key election issues are the economy, earthquake relief operations, and refugees. If no presidential candidate secures more than half of the votes in the first round, a runoff will be held on May 28th. From Istanbul, let's bring in Rashan Saglam, our correspondent, and she's been watching this since it started. Rashan, tell us about it. How did it go?
Yes, the polling stations closed at 5 p.m. Turkey time. Polling stations were actually at that moment jammed with people waiting in line to vote. However, many were not able to vote at that timing because the Electoral Committee, High Committee, said that they will close at exactly 5 p.m. So many people were not able to cast their votes, especially in Istanbul. However, still with that happening, in Istanbul alone, 90% of the people who are eligible or citizens eligible to vote were voted today. So 90% is the voting that happened in Istanbul alone. So this is a huge number. In the previous elections, we would see like 55 or 60%. 90% is a very important number. And also, we have to always mention that this time, it is the youth that are making the difference. It is the young generations that are making the difference. They are eager to vote. They are eager to participate in this election and make a change in the country. At 12 midnight, we are going to know who is at least going to be the president of Turkey for the coming years.
Okay. At 12 midnight, you said?
Yes. At 12 midnight, we are going
final
to know
results.
The president. And as for the parliamentary elections, also it is tight, but not as the presidential run. As we know, we have two candidates, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu are the main candidates. Of course, we have the third one, Sinan Oğan, but I don't think that he is going to gather more than 7% of the votes. And actually, we spoke to several analysts, and we are trying to know what's going to happen, what are the results going to be. Many are saying that the votes who were supposed to be going to Muharrem İnce, the fourth presidential candidate who withdrew 3 days ago from this run, are going to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And actually on Twitter, we saw a lot of citizens taking photographs and videos of them voting or inside the private rooms while casting their votes and giving their votes to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and also at the parliamentary election, they're giving their vote to the political party of Muharrem İnce. So the votes that we were thinking of Muharrem İnce voters are going to Kılıçdaroğlu actually did go to President Erdogan. Also, analysts are saying that they thought that Kılıçdaroğlu will win with 51.4%. I think that this percentage will be very a lot less than that. And I think that it will really be, numbers would really be close. It will be a tight run.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. Rashan Saglam, our correspondent in Istanbul. Now, after 5 days of Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip, a ceasefire has officially come into effect in the besieged territory. The Egypt mediated truce ended the worst episode of fighting since a 10-day war in 2021. Palestinian resistance movement the Islamic Jihad said it would abide by the ceasefire as long as Israel does. The Joint Operations Room of Palestinian Resistance Factions also said that resistance groups are stronger than ever before. The latest Israeli violence erupted when the regime targeted a number of residential areas in Gaza on Tuesday, killing several Islamic Jihad commanders. 33 Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in 5 days of attacks. In response, resistance groups fired more than 1,200 rockets at Israel, targeting as far as Tel Aviv. An Israeli settler was killed and dozens more were wounded. Our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, joined us earlier and told us more about the situation in the besieged territory following that ceasefire.
The Israeli regime has violated it in the first 15, 20 minutes by firing tank shells in the east of Gaza City and also in the east of the southern Gaza Strip town of Rafah. Life in Gaza is returning to normal gradually right now as more vehicles are seen on the streets. People are coming out, although schools are still not working today, schools and universities, because the Ministry of Interior said that they have to check all these educational premises for possible UXOs or unexploded ordnance that were fired by the Israeli regime. For 5 days of Israeli aggression claimed the lives of at least 33 Palestinians in the besieged territory, including 6 children, 3 women, and 4 elderly people. Some 160 others were injured. Among those injured, dozens are still in critical condition, so the number of fatalities is likely to rise in the coming days or weeks, because hospitals in Gaza were already struggling to cope with patients, the critical patients, following 16 years of the Israeli blockade and multiple wars.
Meanwhile, Israeli forces have once again stormed a residential area in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. 2 Palestinians were detained in Huwara for alleged role in an anti-Israel attack in March. Tel Aviv claims that 3 of its troopers were wounded in that incident. Israel has stepped up attacks on the occupied towns and cities in recent months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank so far this year. People across the world have held rallies in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The rallies are held ahead of the 75th anniversary of the creation of the Israeli regime, known as the Day of Nakba or Catastrophe. Rallies were held in many cities across the world, including in Vienna, Rotterdam, Paris, Berlin, and Toronto. Demonstrators slammed the failure of the international community to take action against Israeli atrocities. In London, the rallyers chanted slogans denouncing the UK's role in the creation of the Israeli regime. The Nakba Day marks the creation of the regime in 1948. Zionists who had moved to Palestine from different countries drove over 750,000 Palestinians into exile. They also wiped off more than 500 towns and villages off the map.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
Today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora, the Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession, and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
the Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza, once again suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out. Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing.
What we're asking for as a British public is sanctuary. We're asking for international law to be upheld. If any other country was breaking this many laws this frequently on an international level, sanctions would be placed upon them without doubt. So we're asking for level playing field here, international law to be applied to Israel, sanction Israel now. The Nakba isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long. And we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
Thousands marched in Paris to commemorate 75 years since the Palestinian Nakba, which means catastrophe, the imperialist slaughter and theft by Israelis on a horrific scale in 1948. To achieve their goal of conquering Palestine, Israelis immediately turned 800,000 Palestinians into homeless refugees, used ethnic cleansing to destroy over 400 villages, and massacred over 15,000 people. Since then, Israelis have forcibly displaced a stunning 14 million Palestinians, jailed over 1 million people, and launched an average of 10 police raids every single day. The cruelty Israel has shown towards Palestinians for 75 years has been unending, and the path to justice seems like a long road.
Firstly, it means the end of occupation, because you can always imagine a reconciliation between the rapist and its victim. But this can never happen during the rape. The rape has to cease. And this is the first step.
Even though Muslims outnumber Jews in France by 15 to 1, their support of Palestine is not democratically reflected. Paris has long considered itself as Europe's primary diplomat on the world stage, but many say they do nothing to rein in Israel's daily atrocities and falsely label Palestinian supporters as being against Judaism and Jews.
To label people who defend Palestinians as anti-Semites is a well-known strategy from the Zionist lobby, from the government of Israel, in order to suppress the struggle for sovereignty in Palestine, the human rights in Palestine. Even human rights organizations in Israel are labeled as anti-Semite for defending Palestinian rights and exposing Israeli crimes. This kind of label we cannot accept.
Rarely admitted in the Western media, but common knowledge globally, Israel has turned Gaza into the world's largest prison, where hundreds of Palestinians are murdered by Israelis each year for their land, homes, and beliefs. Israel is currently waging one of its nearly annual wars on Gaza and have killed dozens and wounded over 150 people in the past several days. As many Palestinians remind, the Nakba is ongoing, even if the West would like to ignore it. On May 15th, the United Nations will, for the first time ever, commemorate the massacre, theft, and genocide of 75 years ago. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A fresh fighting report out of Sudan as the conflict between the army and a major paramilitary force shows no sign of abating. On Sunday, heavy shelling and air raids hit parts of the capital, Khartoum, the capital and nearby cities of Bari and Omdurman, as well as western Darfur province, have been the epicenter of the fighting between the army and rapid support forces since last month. Truce deals have been repeatedly broken, and under them, the sides were committed to allowing civilians safe passage from conflict areas. The fighting has left more than 600 people dead. 700,000 people have been displaced. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has paid a visit to the Tehran International Book Fair. The leader toured different sections of the exhibition and spoke with publishers and book readers. The Tehran International Book Fair was held in 1987 for the first time. The 34th edition of the exhibition opened in Tehran on the 10th of May with publishers from Iran and 40 foreign countries in attendance.
A future worth reading, a motto well defined by generations of book lovers that have come together at the annual International Book Fair in Tehran. Iran's biggest cultural event is underway, with over 2,700 domestic publishers offering their latest publications. For the very first time, bookstore owners are also present, with 200 of them offering their books online and the virtual exhibition, a new addition to the annual book fair that is being held for the second year.
I visit the book fair every year. I love reading, and here I can find books on any topics that I like, all under one roof.
Books can help you improve. I personally love books about self-development. I also think it is important for kids to develop good reading habits from a very young age. That's why I've brought my family along.
Reading is the best hobby, and it's great to spend time with people who love reading. This is the biggest collection of books you can find. There is nothing you could possibly ask for that you won't find here. From scientific books to novels and storybooks, there are books for every taste. But what I love about the book fair is that you get to meet writers and poets in person as they take part in sideline events.
100 foreign publishers have attended the fair this year, and as always, books are available to the public at a discount, with special rates for university students, professors, and researchers, turning the event into an opportunity no bookworm would want to miss.
The 34th edition of Tehran's International Book Fair is currently underway in the Iranian capital, and it will continue for another week, providing the best opportunity for book lovers to buy the books that they love. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of first six. My dad, who taught me the art of
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday of spring, May 14th, 2023. I'm Atefer Irfani, hosting this program today. As you may know, Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages from around the world. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our programs. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. And if you have any message for our great listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. As I always say, listeners especially, the Sunday program is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. This is another edition of Listeners Special, and we are back with you. And as usual, we've received many reception reports from around the world, from Seema Paul from India, from Massimo Lombardi from Italy, and Paul Duarte from Portugal. So Seema, Massimo, and Paul, thank you very much for sending us these reception reports. So we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRAB English Radio. As you may know, these reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. And you know why? Because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service for our great listeners around the world. So all of you who have sent in reception reports will be receiving an electronic or EQSL card from us. Thank you. And let's see who has sent us emails and letters from around the world. From Indonesia, we've received an email from Sutomo Huang. Konstantin Provatoro from Russia, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us an email. Muhammad Fazli from Malaysia has sent us an email. From Spain, we've received an email from David Rodriguez. And the last but not the least is an email from Massimo Lombardi from Italy. Stay with us, please. I will be back with you. Welcome back. As I said, Sutomo Huang from Indonesia has sent us a message, an email. So let's see what Sutomo says. Dear friends, I am glad to inform you that I am enjoying your interesting and informative radio programs regularly on your website, internet streaming, and podcasting. The reason for contact you here is I want you to send me some bulletin, postcards, stickers, stamps, etc., promotional items, souvenirs. Please try to send me some more for our references and collection use. With very best wishes and best regards. Salam and warm greetings to you, Sutomo Huang from Indonesia. Many thanks for this email to your favorite radio station, IRIB English Radio. Sutomo Huang from Indonesia, we're so glad to hear your notions and views about our broadcast. And of course, we respect them totally. We're so glad to hear that you are enjoying our interesting and informative radio programs. As sending any material on behalf of our radio is temporarily halted, so please accept our electronic QSL or EQSL as confirmation to your email. Sutomo from Indonesia, thank you again for this email. We wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And from Russia, we've received an email from Konstantin Provatorov, one of our old and regular listeners. Konstantin says, dear staff, I had a great pleasure to log into your station radio IRIB and sending you my reception report, hoping that you will be able to verify it. Would you be kind enough to send me a QSL card? I enclosed audio files recording your broadcast. Thank you in advance for your reply. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Appreciations to you for this message, Konstantin Provotor from Russia. Please accept our electronic QSL as verification, as sending any material, including paper QSL card, is not possible at the time. We wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, Konstantin Provotor from Russia. So, after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. So you just heard a piece of traditional music from Iran, which was really beautiful, and I enjoyed it a lot. So as I said, Muhammad Fazli from Malaysia has sent us an email. Muhammad says, Assalamu alaikum and greetings. Here is the reception report of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The signal quality is fair. The Iranian music was the best part of the broadcast. As usual, the broadcast programs were excellent. If my reception report is helpful, an acknowledgement by QSL would be much appreciated. Thank you. Salam and warmest greetings to you from Tehran to Malaysia to Muhammad Fazli. Many thanks for your support and commitment to your favorite radio station, IRIB English Radio. So you like the Iranian music as well as the programs of IRIB English Radio. It's really good to hear that. We wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you and, of course, your views and notions about our broadcast. So please accept our electronic QSL or EQSL as confirmation to your email, Muhammad Fazli from Malaysia. From Spain, we've received an email from David Rodriguez Ferro. So let's see what David says. Dear Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, hereby I send you a reception report about your recent transmission. It's so great that it is possible to listen to your station with a portable radio receptor. I hope you find my report useful, and if the details are correct, I would appreciate it if you could check it with one of your QSL cards. Best regards and peace. Salam, peace, and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. David Rodriguez Ferro from Spain. Thank you for this email. Of course, carrying a portable radio receptor is, I think, everyone's wish, at least for IRIB English Radio listeners. David Rodriguez Ferro from Spain, thank you for this email. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Please accept our EQSL or electronic QSL from us. Thank you again. We wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you. And after a short break, I will be back with you with an email from Massimo Lombardi from Italy. So let's go to Massimo Lombardi's email from Italy. Massimo Lombardi from Italy says, Hi, I send you my reception report from Savona, Italy. I should say that the overall reception was good. Please send me a QSL to confirm my report. Have a nice day and thank you for your programs. Salam, ciao. Warm greetings from Iran, from Tehran, and from IRA English Radio staff, Massimo Lombardi. Thank you for this email. Please accept our electronic QSL as a confirmation to your email. We wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And of course, we were looking forward to hearing your notions and views about IRB English Radio programs and broadcasts. And that marks the end of our today's edition of Listener's Special. But before saying goodbye, I'd like to send my honest, faithful, and warm appreciations and gratitudes to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters from around the world, including Simo Paul from India, Massimo Lombardi from Italy, Paulo Duarte from Portugal, Sutomo Huang from Indonesia, Konstantin Provatoro from Russia, Mohammad Fadli from Malaysia, and David Rodriguez Ferro from Spain. Dear listeners, please keep in touch with us. We wish you all the best. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
The theme that I've been talking about in this majalis is basically to see those who are close to Amir al-Mu'mineen so that we can relate to them, look at them as role models and examples of what does it mean to be Shia of Ali. Ali is up there, he's Amir al-Mu'mineen. But on the levels of Iman, you have Salman, Miqdad, Abu Dharr, Ammar, and many others. We looked at the example of Salman Farsi, Abu Dharr Ghifari, Sauda bint Ammara al-Hamdaniya, and even the example of Miqdad. I would like to conclude the discussion with one more example of Ammar bin Yasir. Ammar bin Yasir is known as one of the Al-Arkanul Arba'a, one of the four pillars of the support of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And he was among the very early Muslims. Originally, his family comes from Yemeni background. Again, you know, this is the area where you had the support of those who believed in Amir al-Mu'mineen. But of course, his family had settled down in Mecca much before Islam. And as an outsider, they had to associate with one tribe there, as we saw in the example of others, including Miqdad. And so they became Halif, an ally of Banu Makhzum clan in Mecca.
مسكت نهج الولاية وبيعت حدر إمامي وتركت حكي الوجاية وثبتت بالحق كلامي حب الوصي ودليلي وصار حيدر خليلي
حب الوصي ودليلي وصار حيدر خليلي
عشقت حيدر وطاها وفاطمة في رضاها رضيت من له شاكر أنا عمار بن ياسر.
Ammar is one of the earliest Muslims. He actually was a friend of the Prophet even before Islam, and almost same age as the Prophet. And during the early days when they used to meet in the house of Arqam, it became famous as Darul Arqam. That was the gathering place of the Muslims in Mecca. That's where he and his friend Suhaib bin Sanan became Muslim together. It was through his influence that his parents also, you know, moved towards Islam. You know, sometimes we only think the parents would influence the children. This is opposite. It is the son influencing the parents to become Muslims. However, when the faith of Islam started increasing, this is where the mushrikeen, you know, started adopting different strategies to prevent this mission of the Prophet. And one of the things they did was they started pressurizing those who were not from prominent families or didn't have tribal support. So people like Miqdad or people like Ammar and his family, who are basically confederates or allies or halif and client of another clan there, that's where you see that these are the people who are known as mustadhafin, the weak ones in society. They didn't have full rights. And so the mushrikeen started basically physically torturing them so that they may renounce Islam. People like Bilal, you heard his story. He was a slave and the master started, you know, physically torturing him. And that also happened to the family of Ammar. His parents, himself and his brother Abdullah, they were all physically tortured so that they may renounce Islam. The Prophet would pass by, but he couldn't do much at that time. He would just, you know, console them by saying, Sabran ya Ali Yasir, maw'idukum al-jannah. Maintain patience. The promise that I have for you is that whatever happens, you will have the Jannah at the end. And Ammar's, you know, parents also resisted till the end. Means they were tortured to the point of death. Ammar was there, still tied, and he could see that the father and mother refused to renounce Islam. And they, you know, Yasir and Sumayya became the first martyrs in the history of Islam. And this is where, you know, Ammar, when he saw the torture of his own parents, in order to save his own life, he renounced Islam verbally and praised the idols of Quraysh. And because of that, they let him go. They said, okay, you are fine now, go. He immediately goes to Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and he was crying. Not crying for his parents. He says, Rasulullah, I was forced to save my life and I uttered these words against you. What will happen to me? This is the early days of Islam. You know, the rules have not yet come in. And that is where Rasulullah asked him, tell me, when you were uttering these words of kufr, was your heart at peace with Iman or not? He says, yes, these were only words. I was at peace as far as my Iman is concerned. And at that time, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent down the ayat number 106 of chapter 16. This ayat specially came for Ammar, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Man kafara billahi min ba'di imanihi." Whoever disbelieves after the Iman, illa man ukriha wa qalbuhu mutma'innun bil Iman. So this is the judgment about somebody who becomes kafir after becoming a mu'min. But then Allah puts an exception there. إِلَّا مَنْ أُكْرِهَا وَقَلْبُهُ مُطْمَعِنٌ بِالْإِيمَانِ. Except somebody who was forced because of the circumstances. While his heart was still at peace with faith. وَمَنْ شَرَحَ بِالْكُفْرِ صَدْرًا. However, whoever opens their hearts towards kufr, not only on you know, tongue, فَعَلَيْهِمْ غَضَبٌ مِنَ اللَّهِ وَلَهُمْ عَذَابٌ عَظِيمٌ. They will have Allah's wrath and severe punishment in the hereafter. This is, we see this, the first ayat about the principle of taqiyya. Taqiyya, you know, dissimulation, where you say words of kufr in order to save your own life or honor or property. Depends on the severity of the situation.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Britain's former PM struck Iraq in 1998 to please Bill Clinton, according to files published by an investigative website. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to documents published by Declassified UK, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair ordered the 1998 bombing of Iraq, despite repeated warnings that such a move was unlawful. Blair would follow the same template, insisting that illegal military action was legal when the UK invaded Iraq in 2003. The US and UK launched a four-day bombing campaign against Iraq in December 1998 after then-US President Bill Clinton accused Saddam Hussein of breaching commitments to the UN and developing weapons of mass destruction. As many as 1,400 Iraqi soldiers were killed in strikes on around 100 military facilities. In the run-up to the bombings, Blair was repeatedly told by his advisors that using force against Iraq would be illegal without a resolution from the UN Security Council, according to the documents from the National Archives, cited by Declassified UK, an investigative outlet that focuses on Britain's military and intelligence agencies. Attorney General John Morris reportedly told Blair in November 1997 that obtaining a statement from the Security Council would be an essential precondition to military action, while Blair's private secretary, John Holmes, told the Prime Minister that British law officers and Foreign Secretary Robin Cook had a serious problem about using force unless the Security Council declares that Iraq is in material breach of previous resolutions. When the law officers refused to authorize the military to draw up targeting plans, Blair reportedly wrote to Holmes, stating that he found their argument unconvincing. Blair continuously received warnings throughout 1998, the report alleged, with Cook's private secretary writing to Holmes that February to warn that the negative implications for international support if we resort to military action without a new resolution would be serious. When Blair announced military action to Parliament in November, he declared, "I have no doubt that we have the proper legal authority as it is continued in successive Security Council resolution documents." British officials claimed that a 1990 resolution authorizing UN members to force Saddam's army out of Kuwait gave them permission to intervene again in Iraq, an argument that only the US, Japan, and Portugal supported. According to the documents, Blair saw bombing Iraq as essential to maintaining his close relationship with Clinton. In a meeting with advisors in November, he supposedly said that failing to intervene would cause extreme damage to US-UK relations. That same day, even as his own aides maintained that intervention was illegal, Blair told Clinton that the US could count on air support. 5 years later, Blair would find himself in the same situation when he falsely claimed that Saddam was harboring weapons of mass destruction and invoked earlier Security Council resolutions to justify invading Iraq. Again, Blair was warned by his attorney general that military action would defy international law, and again, he pressed ahead regardless. More than a decade later, a public inquiry found that the legal case for the invasion was far from satisfactory, while then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan maintained from the outset that the war was illegal. According to Reuters, documents reveal Tony Blair was repeatedly told it was illegal to invade Iraq when it was illegal, but he ordered British troops to do it anyway. Former Prime Minister English Tony Blair ordered invasion of Iraq in 1998 despite being repeatedly told that such actions were against the law. This was revealed in documents published by Declassified UK. Blair was following a similar pattern, insisting that illegal military action was legal when Britain invaded Iraq in 2003. The US and UK launched a four-day bombing campaign against Iraq in December 1998. After then, US President Bill Clinton accused President Saddam Hussein of violating commitments to the United Nations and developing weapons of mass destruction. As many as 1,400 Iraqi troops were killed in attacks on about 100 military facilities. In the lead-up to the bombing, Blair was repeatedly told by advisors that using force against Iraq would be illegal without a resolution from the United Nations Security Council, according to documents from the National Archives cited by Declassified UK, an investigative outlet focused on Britain's military and intelligence agencies. Blair received constant warnings throughout 1998, according to the declassified UK report in which Cook's private secretary wrote to Holmes in February, warning that the negative implications for international support if we take military action without new resolutions will be serious. When Blair announced military action to Parliament in November, he stated, "I have no doubt that we have the proper legal authority as contained in successive Security Council resolution documents."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023. The freedom of Islam is freedom. Islam does not confine us in the framework of materialism. You were created to remain, not to perish. Shia Creeds 47. We will not stop existing. As the Persian poet Rumi says, the time has arrived to pass away and to search. Every created thing shall perish except his face. Dying is not the end. Dying is the beginning of a new stage. In fact, the main stage. When you look at it this way, that's when you can soar, and your movement, your progress, and your transcendence will no longer be limited. This is freedom. All the freedoms in life, including personal freedom, freedom of opinion, being freed from the captivity of immobility, stagnation, lethargy, and all kinds of backwardness, meaningless prejudices, and freedom from the captivity of the superpowers and dictators, are all the results of the foundations of Islamic freedom.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You need to think about these and work on them. The solution is not for me to come and talk to you about these things for half an hour, for instance. You need to work on these yourselves. You need to think. You need to read books. Or consider the concept of awaiting the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, ajjalallahu ta'ala farajuhu sharif. This awaiting the Saviour is one of the important foundations of our intellectual and religious principles. Awaiting the Saviour means that all difficulties can be eliminated and removed. This does not mean one should merely sit around and wait. Rather, you need to be alert. In the story of Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, his mother was told, "We will return him to you and make him one of the messengers." The Holy Quran, Surah 28, verse 7. "We will return this child to you, make him one of the messengers, and he will save you." This strengthened the Israelites. The Israelites practiced resistance in Egypt under Pharaoh for many years. Of course, they ruined everything later on, but they resisted for many years. It was this resistance that brought Moses to them. He started his movement and they followed him. This led to the destruction of Pharaoh and his system.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.